It's 8:01, and people are here not to hear our discussion, but to learn about this week, the translations of Tanakh, Rav Sadia Gaon, from what I took a quick peek at the sources. And it's been a long time, 2 weeks since our last class. So I hope everybody, well, maybe have to do a quick a chazarish here to get us all up back up to speed. But welcome back, Dr. Sokolow. Hope you had an enjoyable Purim and that Aura and Simcha in other ways, unlike our Wednesday night Torah class. And Vakasha, time to get started. Here we go. Translations number 3.
Okay. So let me enlarge it. Okay.
They don't give me within 4 seconds, if I don't have the sources up, you know, I get like, I have to be on the ball like anything. Okay. Bakasha.
Okay. So what we've should have noticed since we began this segment on translations is that the act of translation is an art. It's an art and a science. The scientific part of it is the linguistic part. In order to be able to be an effective translator, one has to be arguably fluent in both the language of the original text from which one is translating and the so-called target language, the one into which the translation is being prepared. But we've already taken note of the fact, and we will so more this evening, that no two languages are that similar to each other that you can substitute one word in the target language for a single word in the source language. Therefore, there's always an element of art to the translation, and that is particularly so when translating idiomatic expressions or translating metaphors. The question always is, if you use an equivalent idiom or an equivalent metaphor in the target language, then you have effectively communicated the sense of the original, but the expense of the flavor of the original. While if you give a more laborious literal translation, what's called a slavish translation, then you've conveyed more of the flavor of the original, but possibly at the expense of comprehension. So we will see this evening how Sa'adia Gaon dealt with some of those things, and we will see that as well when we do the concluding session on translations next week, when we look at some English translations. But now for Sa'adia Gaon, you may remember him well from the time that we devoted to him as a parshan, as a commentator, but just to remind you that he lived, as you can see, from the end of the 9th to the middle of the 10th century. He was born in the oasis of Fayyum in Egypt, and he is therefore known also in later Jewish and Muslim literature as the Fayyumi, the one who came from Fayyum. And it would appear from some of the things that he wrote that he lived for a while and probably was educated in the land of Israel. Ultimately, somewhere around the year 920, 21 or thereabouts, the early 920s, he was selected to be the Gaon, the dean, so to speak, of the Surah Academy in Baghdad. The fact that they went all the way to Egypt to find a Rosh Yeshiva for Baghdad is significant, but it's likely that he was chosen because he had already at that time established a reputation, not just a reputation as a Talmid Chacham, but a reputation as somebody who stood up for principle. And probably the principle for which Sa'adia stood up more than any other is the principle of his devotion to rabbinic tradition. Sadia Gotin is perhaps best known, certainly historically, as the staunch defender of rabbinic tradition against what in the beginning of the 10th century were the increasing, both in number and in effect, the increasing attacks on rabbinic Judaism that were launched primarily by the Karaites. Karaites in Hebrew, Karaim or B'nai Mikra, were a Jewish sect. I should say, war as though there are no Karaites anymore, but still are Karaites, but not nearly in the numbers or with the influence that they had 1,000 years ago. But as you might tell from the name B'nai Mikra, what distinguished Karaites was their rejection of the Talmud and of rabbinic tradition. They believed that one could see one's way through Jewish life with a Chamisha Chumshei Torah, or perhaps maybe a bit more expansive, with a Tanakh in their hands, and without any need for subsequent rabbinic literature. Saadia Gaon, as I said, was the defender of the faith, so to speak. And we will see, in fact, how he utilized his Arabic translation of the Torah in order to promote rabbinic values and to defend rabbinic tradition. His Arabic translation has an Arabic name, not surprisingly, and the name is Tafsir. In the word Tafsir, I realize I should have spelled it out in Hebrew, Tav Fe Samach Yod Resh, you might recognize the Shoresh Pe, well, in Arabic it would be Pe Samach Resh. In Hebrew, it would be either Pe Shin Resh, which produces the word Pesher, which means an interpretation, or it could produce the word, the Shoresh Pe Tav Resh, which produces the word pitaron, also an interpretation or a solution. So in essence, if one looks at an act of translation as the solution to a puzzle, then one could see why a translation would earn for itself the name tafsir. Just a reminder, we've looked at the next couple of sources already in another context. It's simply a reminder of the prominent role that Arabic language began to play in Judaism, beginning somewhere around the 9th century of the present era. Here we have kind of like an addendum that Ibn Ezra in the 12th century wrote to his commentary on Shir HaShirim. Why did he put it here? Probably because Shir HaShirim has, for a text of its relatively limited size, 8 prakim, has an astonishing number of rare or unusual words in it. Okay? Therefore, Ibn Ezra, more frequently in his commentary on Shir HaShirim than in his commentary on other biblical books, occasionally resorted to Arabic as a way of explaining things to his audience. And here he provides a rationale for his use of Arabic. And he wrote, "The reader of this commentary may wonder why I employ Arabic. He calls it Lashon Yishmael. And he says that it is a consequence of our ignorance. Kotzer da'atenu. Of what are we ignorant, he says? Basically, he says, our knowledge of biblical Hebrew is limited. It's limited to what the biblical text records. And the biblical text records speeches of prophets. And prophets only spoke about those things that they were instructed to speak about. Whereas, he says, whatever they had no need to speak of, any subject that simply did not find its way into the mouth of a prophet, so to speak, remains unknown. I believe at the time I gave the example of, we don't even really know, although we have perhaps one indication, of how people greeted each other in the biblical period. Nowadays, people greet each other, they say, Shalom Aleichem, right? The only indication we have is that in the book of Ruth, we're told that when Boaz showed up at his field spoke with his field workers, right? They exchanged the greeting where he said to them, Hashem imachem, right? May God be with you. And they responded to him, Yivarechecha Hashem, may God bless you. Now, we don't know. That might have been something that was exclusive to Boaz. It might have been something that was exclusive to Beit Lechem. Or for all we know, it could be the way in which any two people would greet each other on occasion. But as Ibn Ezra correctly said, since, you know, daily greetings, right, those mundane things are not the subject of prophetic discourse, they somehow did not find their way into Tanakh. Therefore, there are many things in Tanakh that are mentioned only once. And because they're mentioned only once, we don't really know exactly what they mean. Therefore, says Ibn Ezra in continuation, since Arabic is very close to Hebrew, and he gives some examples of the proximity of Arabic to Hebrew, conjugations, right? In Hebrew, we have binyanim, conjugations. We call one binyan kal, simple. We call one binyan pi'el, which is more emphatic. We call one binyan nif'al, which is kind of like reflexive. We call one binyan hif'il, that is to cause something to happen. Those same binyanim exist in Arabic. Therefore, we can compare Hebrew, the conjugation of Hebrew verbs, to the conjugation of Arabic verbs. And in fact, Hebrew grammar, as we know it today, has its origins in Spain and in North Africa during the 10th and 11th centuries, when people like Ibn Ezra all of a sudden came to the realization that they could learn about the Hebrew language by studying Arabic. Okay. Therefore, coming to the end of the second paragraph, he says, anytime we encounter an unusual word in the Bible that has what he calls a chaver, a cognate in Arabic, that is to say that the Arabic word is spelled reasonably the same way as the Hebrew word, then we will suggest that they share a definition. Although, and in this he's very stringent, says, although it remains questionable, meaning his understanding, his knowledge of Hebrew and Arabic was so extensive that he understood that the fact that you have a word in Arabic that seems to be similar to a word in Hebrew, it doesn't yet mean that they're completely interchangeable. And I don't know whether I gave this example at the time, but just to give you an example. The root, the shoresh, kaf, tav, vet, in Hebrew, produces a variety of different meanings that all share the feature of something either being written or, after it's written, being read. So you have lichtov, which is to write something, and then you have the word michtav, which is something that has been written. The same shoresh, kaf, tav, vet, in Arabic, produces a verb that means to write, and a noun, kitab, which means a book. So that's just one illustration, a simple illustration of, again, how one can match what Ibn Ezra calls cognate words in Hebrew and in Arabic. One more example, and then we'll move on. The shoresh dalid resh shin in Hebrew, right? We recall, for example, that when Rivka needed some guidance or some enlightenment in terms of her condition. It says, "Vatelech lidrosh et Hashem." So lidrosh means to seek, to inquire. Okay. From that, we get words like drasha, which is arguably an inquiry into a biblical text. Okay. So we also get from that the word beit midrash, which is a place in which inquiry into biblical or into rabbinic texts takes place. Same thing in Arabic, there's a verb darasa. The verb darasa means to study. And from the verb darasa, we get the noun madrasa, which is effectively identical to midrash. It's a school, a place where learning or inquiry take place. This text also we saw previously. I'm not even going to go through it. It makes essentially the same point. It comes from, again, a commentary on Shir HaShirim by Rabbi Yosef ibn Aknin. Rabbi Yosef ibn Aknin was a younger contemporary of Maimonides in the latter half of the 12th century. And he also drew our attention to the fact that many leading Jewish authorities during the High Middle Ages, particularly those who lived either in the Middle East, in Muslim Spain, or in North Africa, used Arabic. They used Arabic the way we use English. Okay. I'm sorry, how did that happen? Okay. Forgive me for just a moment, because it seems that this is a bit out of order, and I need to restore order.
It's not yet Pesach. You know, we're still in the unorder.
Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Here we go. This is what, this should have been up there. Okay. Yes. Okay. So we see that Ibn Ezra was quite astute when it came to matters of what we call comparative Semitics. And here, this is a passage that we also saw previously when we looked at Ibn Ezra as a Parshan. And we took note of the fact that Saadia, to whom Ibn Ezra refers as either Hagaon or occasionally as Rosh HaMidabrim B'chol Makom, right? The person who has the right, the first right to speak, that Ibn Ezra very frequently relates to us insights into the text that he drew from the translation or from the commentaries of Saadia Gaon. And certainly until the 20th century, we were indebted to Ibn Ezra because the commentaries of Saadia Gaon were lost. They were recovered. His Torah commentaries were recovered in the 20th century from the Cairo Geniza, but only in a fragmentary form. So we still owe Ibn Ezra a tremendous debt of gratitude for having preserved whatever comments of Saadia he did. Now, here is one apropos of a verse early on in the book of Bereshit. The one that tells us v'nahar yotze me'eden lahashkot et hagan, that a river flowed out of the gar and irrigated the Garden of Eden, and then when it exited, when it left the Garden of Eden, it says u'misham yipared, that river would split v'hayala arba'a rashim, and it split into four separate rivers, okay? Four tributaries, so to speak. Okay, Shem Ha'echad, right? The name of the first of these four tributaries, the Torah says, is Pishon. Okay, they are Pishon, Gichon, Prat, and Chidekel. Okay, now Prat is the Euphrates. There's no question about that. And Chidekel doesn't quite sound like Tigris, but if you take the last consonants Dekel, and you take Tigris, you can begin to sense that there is some sort of philological relationship between them. But whereas the Euphrates and the Tigris are well known, they are the two rivers of Mesopotamia. You may remember from a long ago occasion that I pointed out that the word Mesopotamia literally means between the rivers, right? Meso, the prefix meso, means in the middle or between, and potamos is Greek for a river. So Mesopotamia literally is between the two rivers, and the two rivers of Mesopotamia are the Euphrates and the Tigris. Okay, so two out of the four rivers of the Garden of Eden were clearly the rivers of Mesopotamia, the Tigris and the Euphrates. Not at all clear what the other two rivers, the Pishon and the Gihon, were. However, if one were to ask oneself, and certainly if one were to ask others, right, name a few of the great rivers of the ancient world, okay, and we're not going into the Ganges, I mean, not that far into, you know, Southeast Asia. If we're talking about what we tend to call the cradle of civilization, right, the Fertile Crescent, okay, then along with the Tigris and the Euphrates, I bet you that the next two most frequent answers you get are the Jordan and the Nile. So Saadia, in fact, identified the Pishon with the Nile. As Ibn Ezra says, Amar HaGaon ki Pishon Ye'or Mitzrayim. Okay. Now, Saadia may have made that identification on the basis of an historical tradition. Saadia may have made that identification on the basis of the fact that he was born in the oasis of Fayum, which is in the Nile River, and therefore he might just have identified it as the Nile as a favor to his hometown, right? Or it could be, as Ibn Ezra seems to imply, that it might have been a bit of guesswork, meaning he knows that it's not the Tigris, he knows that it's not the Euphrates, he assumes that it's got to be one of the other great rivers of the Middle East, and therefore, you know, process of elimination, it could be the Nile. But I'm more interested in what Ibn Ezra says. Ibn Ezra is not persuaded by Saadia. As much as he respected Saadia and revered him, he was not persuaded that all of Saadia's identifications of persons, places, and things in the Torah were necessarily accurate. If, however, they're not accurate, then does that imply that Saadia was somehow trying to put one over on us? No, says Ibn Ezra. Hence his last sentence here. Ulai asachen lichvod Hashem. He says, I don't think for a moment that Saadia did this in order to fool people. Surely, he says, that he did this for the honor of God, translating the Torah into the Arabic language and script. Why? He says, Shelo yomeru, meaning that Muslims should not say, Kiyesh batorah mitzvot lo yeda'anu, that they should not be able to accuse us of not knowing what things in the Torah mean. And I believe that at the time I gave the example, that if, for example, if you say that you don't know which river the Pishon is, right? Because, see, after all, it appears only once in the Bible, and it's referring to something from a long time ago, and therefore, you know, I don't really know what it is, then why should I take your word for it when you tell me that totafot are tefillin? After all, the word totafot, like the word pishon, it appears only once, right? It refers to something very, very old, right? So, therefore, what Saadia basically did was that in order to at least give the impression that Jewish tradition can identify everything in the Torah, it forced him into the situation where he had to offer identifications of things that it really doesn't matter what they are, but he was forced into giving their identifications in order, as I said, to preserve the integrity of rabbinic tradition. And by the way, we'll look at some English translations next week and see, for example, what do they do when they come across proper nouns in the Torah? Do they, like Saadia, translate them? Meaning, do they find equivalents in other languages for them? Or do they transliterate them? Meaning, will an English translation say the first one of the rivers was the Nile? Or will it say one of the rivers was Pishon? Okay. So as I said, bear this in mind. And now let's look at some of Saadia's translations. And I decided that I would share this with you. Didn't even realize at first that it actually comes with sound. This is the first page. You can see the first pasuk of the Torah in the upper right hand, Reshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. But if you see that immediately following the biblical verse is the Aramaic translation of Onkelos, Milak Bikadmin at the beginning, Bro Hashem Yos Shemayo V'Yos Ar'o. That's Onkelos's Aramaic rendition of the first verse of the Torah. Following that, you see a whole bunch of Hebrew letters that, first of all, are not Hebrew, not even Aramaic, and they don't even have vowels. Okay? That is Judeo-Arabic. When Saadia, right, and Rambam, Yehuda Halevi, Bachya ibn Pekuda, right, when the Jewish sages and philosophers of the Middle Ages wrote in Arabic, they were not writing, certainly not primarily for an Arab audience, they were writing for Jewish audiences. And even though Jews in those days were fluent, certainly Jewish scholars were fluent in Arabic, they weren't necessarily fluent in reading the Arabic script. Therefore, in order to capitalize on the fact that everybody, right, not just scholars, but that everybody, all the Jews in the Muslim world were acquainted with Arabic, and all Jews, not only in the Muslim world, but particularly in the Muslim world, all Jews could read the Hebrew alphabet, the Gaonim and their successors wrote in what is called Judeo-Arabic, and that is that they wrote Arabic words using the Hebrew alphabet. Okay? And to give you a sense of how this, so this book that you see, where every pasuk is followed first by the Aramaic translation of Onkelos, and then subsequently by the Arabic tafsir translation of Saadia Gaon, this book has a name, this genre. It is called by an Arabic name. It's called a taj. Taj, Hebrew has a word also, tag, and it's essentially a crown. And this book is a distinctive feature of Yemenite Jewish life. Yemenites, traditional Yemenites, right, when they go over every week's Torah reading, do it with both the Aramaic translation of Onkelos and the Arabic translation of Saadia. And I was rather surprised to find this. Let me see how I can share this with you. Okay, let me let you into this and hope that it works. You see it, Keter Torah? Okay, so you can see this is the cover, the title page. It's called Keter. I told you it's the word Taj. You can see the word Tav Aleph Gimel. It's pronounced Taj. Okay. And it says, V'hu chamishachum she Torah, right? The five books of the Torah, in with Tirgum Onkelos, right? The Aramaic Targum of Onkelos, and Tirgum Rabbeinu Sa'adya Gaon Bilshon Aravi. And this, as I said, the first volume. There are two volumes to the set, and the first one has Bereshit and Shemot. But what you're going to hear now is you're going to hear the Arabic text recited. And it's going to be recited not by a Yemenite Jew, it's recited actually by an Iraqi Jew. But the curious thing is that his explanation of it, and I decided to keep it all the same, his explanation of it is actually provided in Arabic. This is a rather unusual website. It clearly was meant to explain things about Judaism to Arabs. So let's just play it. As you see, it's just a couple of minutes.
الكتاب اليهودي الدرس الأول بقراءة التوراة.
Right? I told you the word kitab before means a book, right? And the word dars means a lesson. So he said al-kitab al-yahudi, the Jewish book, right? That would be the Torah, right? Ad-dars al-awwal, the first lesson.
At-Tawrah. الكتاب الأول كتاب برشيت البرشة الأولى برشة برشيت بالعبرية وبالعربية اليهودية بتفسير رساق ترجمة ربي سعد يقعون وهو الحخام سعيد الفيومي.
Okay, he gave you an introduction. He gave you both his Jewish name Sa'ad Yagaon and the name by which he is known in Arabic literature. That would be Sa'id al-Fayumi, right? Sa'adya, who came from the town of Fayum.
בראשית ברא אלוהים את השמיים ואת הארץ. אולה מחלק אללה السماوات والارض.
Okay, notice he skipped the Aramaic, right? He's only interested in the Arabic, and he pronounced it as though he were reading classical Arabic. I knew right away that this was not a Yemenite, because a Yemenite reading the first pasuk of the Torah would read it as follows: Bereshit Boro Elohim et hashomayim wa et ha'oretz. Right? Yemenites use what we call Sephardic vowels, meaning an O is read as A, but they use what we call Ashkenazic consonants, meaning the letter Sav, unless it has a dagesh in it, is pronounced S. As soon as I heard him read Bereshit Bara, I knew it wasn't a Yemenite. So I looked him up and discovered that, in fact, he's Iraqi. Okay, we'll just have him read another pasuk or so, and then we'll go back.
Ve'ha'aretz hayta tohu vavohu, ve'choshech al pnei tehom, ve'ruach Elohim merachefet al pnei hamayim. Wal'ardu kenet ghamiratan mustabharatan, wal'dalamun ala wajhi al-ghamiri, wa'riyahu allahi tahubu ala wajhi al-mahi. Vayomer Elohim, yehi or, vayehi or. Fasha'a allahu an yakuna nurun, fakana nurun. Vayar Elohim et ha'or kitov, ויבדל אלוהים בין האור ובין החושך. פלמה עלימה אללהו אן נורה ג'יידון, פסלה בין הנורי ודלמי.
Okay, as I said, the URL, the link is on the slide, and if you want to go back and hear more of it, you'll be able to do it on your own. Okay, and we can move on. Okay, so here I arranged as a table Sa'adya's translations of segments of the first several psukim in the Torah, actually psukim that he just read for us. Okay, so the right-hand column, of course, has the biblical text. The second column from the right is labeled Tafsir. That's Saadia's Arabic translation. The third column is Saadia's Arabic translation in English. And the fourth column is the Jewish Publication Society translation of that same verse. So we can see where Saadia's Arabic translation differs from, let's call it, the standard or conventional English translation. Okay? So, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. That, of course, is the famous opening of King James. And, you know, it really wasn't until the 20th century that you would dare find an English translation that had anything else. Okay? But the Jewish Publication translation, and this is not the first Jewish Publication Society translation of 1917, but rather the later Jewish Publication Society translation of, I think, 1964, translates it more in keeping with the way that traditional Jewish Parshanut understood it. And that is that the word Bereshit doesn't mean in the beginning, but it actually means at the beginning of something. So Jewish Publication Society translates Bereshit Bara as when God began to create. Saadia renders it somewhat similarly as Awal Ma Chalaka, meaning the first of God's creation was heaven and earth. So again, it recognizes that the word Bereshit is not an absolute noun. It's what we call a construct noun. It's a noun in smichut. Bereshit means the beginning of something. Okay. Then it says, Vayomer Elohim Yihi Or. And this is very interesting because this is a feature that we've spoken about on previous occasions and will yet see again. Namely, the attempt on the part of commentators or of translators to minimize the element of anthropomorphism. You may recall that I mentioned on at least one previous occasion that Maimonides in the Guide to the Perplexed reminded us that the most ubiquitous metaphor in the Bible is Vayedaber Hashem, because God, strictly speaking, cannot speak. Therefore, Saadia does not translate Vayomer Elohim as God said. He translates it as God desired. Meaning what the Torah expresses as a form of speech is really a way of anthropomorphizing God's desire that there should be light. And then in the next verse it says, Vayar Elohim et ha'or kito. God saw the light and that it was good. Now, the problem there is he didn't know that the light was good. Of course he knew the light was good. He didn't have to see the light in order to know that it was good. Therefore, Saadia's rendition of the verse is, since God knew that the light was good, right, etc. Then it says, Vayikra Elohim la'or yom, JPS, God called the light day, v'lachoshech kara laila, and he called the darkness night. The problem here is a simple logical problem. Light and day are not entirely synonymous. They're certainly not identical. Neither are darkness and night. Okay? Day and night are periods of time that generally are regulated. We regulate them by the clock. We don't regulate them by the presence or absence of sunlight. Right? That's why in the winter, right, night can fall at 4 p.m. Okay? So, Saadia's rendition of the verse is that God named the times of light day and the times of darkness night, meaning a better, a keener understanding or a more, with greater specificity that we're not talking about. It's not that all light is day and all darkness is night, but the time of day in which it's usually light is called daytime, and the time of day in which it's usually dark is called nighttime. Later on in Bereshit, another logical problem. God, after Yaakov wins in his struggle with whomever he struggled, says, God says to him, right, Shimcha Yaakov, right, your name is Jacob, Lo Yikare Shimcha Od Yaakov, your name will no longer be known as Yaakov, Kim Yisrael Yiyeshemecha, rather, you will be known as Yisrael. Okay? Now again, look at the English translation on the left-hand side of the JPS. You, right, whose name is Yaakov, you shall be called Jacob no more. Rather, but you shall be called Israel. Now, here is a very simple problem. It's not true. It's true that after Avram had his name changed to Avraham, he's never again called Avram. But it's not true that after God changed Yaakov's name to Yisrael, that he was never again called Yaakov. It's just simply not true. Therefore, Saadia's rendition of the verse reflects that. And he has God say to him, your name Yaakov will not forever be Yaakov only, rather Yisrael. And when it says, Vayikra et Shemo Yisrael, he add, he named him Jacob, he named him Israel also, to indicate, of course, his appreciation of the fact that subsequently you might occasionally find him called Yaakov, you might occasionally find him called Yisrael. Here's a classic, okay? Et Akedah. God says to Abraham when he tells him Al tishlach yadcha el hanar, right? Don't reach your hand with the knife out towards Yitzchak. Al taslo meuma, don't do anything to him. Why? Ki ata yada'ati ki yirei Elohim ata. For now, as it says in the JPS, for now I know that you fear God. Now, this too is a great philosophical challenge. A moment before, God didn't know what Abraham would do. God is omniscient. And God's omniscience means that God knows everything all the time. So if God knows everything all the time, then even before Abraham reached his hand out towards Isaac, God knew that he was God-fearing. So again, you can see that Saadia's rendition of the verse tries to alleviate that problem. Saadia translates yada'ati, which is the binyan kal, and literally means I know, as though it were the binyan hif'il, the causative. And he translates it as not that I know now, but rather now I have let other people know that you are God-fearing. Now again, this is an instance in which Ibn Ezra did us a favor by preserving Saadia's interpretation for us. But once again, you can see that Ibn Ezra did not feel himself obligated to accept it. And he tells us that Saadia Gaon said that the beginning of the story, Elohim nisai et Abraham, right? That it means that God tested Abraham for what purpose? Not to find out something that God didn't already know. The purpose of the test was not for God to discover something about Abraham, but the purpose of the test was for God to be able to demonstrate something about Abraham to other people. Okay? And furthermore, he interpreted, for now I know that you are God-fearing to me, now I have made known to others that you are God-fearing. And Ibn Ezra says, wait a second, who are the others? There's nobody there. It's just Abraham and Isaac. Even the two young men who accompanied them did not go up the mountain with them. They were left behind. Therefore, Ibn Ezra basically says, how can Saadia say that God is saying, I wanted you to become known to other people when there was nobody there? Now, I've never met Saadia Gaon, but I have a good feeling that I know what he would have answered Ibn Ezra. And I think it would have answered Ibn Ezra, you know who was there? Anybody who reads the story in the Torah. He doesn't mean necessarily to make it known to an immediate audience. Of course he knew that there was nobody there. but it meant that Abraham's nature of fearing God would be made known to anybody who read the story. Here's another example that was preserved by Ibn Ezra, right? In Shmot and Parshat Mishpatim, famous ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, an arm for an arm, a foot for a foot, right? Notice that Sa'adya added a word to the beginning of the translation. He added the word wadiyah, which means ransom. This, of course, in keeping with rabbinic tradition that says that ayin tachat ayin is not what is called in Latin lex talionis, not literally an eye for an eye, but that if you cause damage to somebody else's eye, you had to pay for that damage. And here again, Ibn Ezra shared it with us and told us, Rabbi Sa'adya said, that we cannot interpret this verse according to its plain meaning, meaning we can't do it literally, for a simple logical reason. If a man were to strike his neighbor's eye, and the eye lost a third of its sight, how is it possible to punish the culprit with an equivalent blow? That is, how can you be sure that if you hit the culprit, that he'll lose only a third of his eyesight, right? No more, no less. There's even a possibility that you could hit him too hard and he'd lose all of his eyesight. Furthermore, he says that burns, right? Wounds, right? Kviya, etc., petza, right? Present even greater difficulties. Because if they were inflicted on a dangerous area, right, then it's possible if you did it in turn to the culprit that you might not just cause a greater injury, you might cause him to lose his life. And when he says the mind cannot accept this, he means that it's simply not rational. Therefore, he understands that it cannot be taken literally. It has to be understood as it was understood by the rabbis to be a monetary fine. Here's an example that has nothing philosophical about it, nothing theological about it. It's simply a question of what is your feeling for language. In the description of the menorah in the Mishkan, the Torah describes the menorah as having kaftorim. Okay, a kaftor in modern Hebrew is a button. It's obviously something that was round, but whether it was a round button or whether it was something else, doesn't really matter, okay? I looked up the word calyx because it's used by, the JPS translation, and that's why I chose for my translation of Sa'adya the word pod, right? It's obviously something that's roundish, but it's probably more associated with something floral, right, than with, an item of clothing, okay? So, notice. It talks about kaftor tachat shnei kanim imena, that beneath every two branches of the menorah, there was something round. The kaftor tachat shnei kanim imena. And then again, under two other branches, there was a kaftor. The kaftor tachat shnei kanim imena. And again, that there was something round beneath the two branches. For a total of sheshet hakanim hayotzim imena, because remember that there were two branches on either side. So where the two branches met in the center of the menorah, there was something round there. So it was to happen three times because there were three sets of two arms. Look what Sa'adya just said. There was a kaftor beneath each pair of kanim for the six kanim in the menorah. Why does he have to go over and say again? Two for this, and two for this, and two for this, for total. Says it's enough. This is just simply a sense. I mean, there's nothing lost. We talk about the phrase "lost in translation." There's nothing lost in this translation, okay? Except, as I said, the flavor of the original. There may just be something aesthetic that's missing in Sa'adya's translation, and that is preserved in the JPS translation. Davka on account of its more slavish rendition. Here again, an alteration, so to speak, in the translation. Again, just simply based on the context. Okay, talking about the place where Moses and Aaron sinned, right, by striking the rock instead of speaking to it, or whatever the case was. Okay. It's designated, the site was designated as Mei Meriva, right? The waters of, I don't know, strife, right? And why were they so called? Asher Ravu v'nei Yisrael et Hashem v'yikadesh bam. Look at the JPS. That the Israelites quarreled with God. But they didn't quarrel with God, Sa'adya points out. They quarreled with the messengers of God. Right? Their quarrel wasn't with God. Their quarrel was with Moses and Aaron. Okay. Notice, by the way, if you look at the Arabic text, the third line, the word that's highlighted in yellow, is the Arabic word for messenger. That's the word Rasul. Right? I can't say everybody knows, but lots of people, you know that Muhammad is designated in Arabic as Rasul Allah, means God's messenger. Okay, so Sa'adya uses the same descriptive term, messenger, for Moses as a prophet of God. Okay. This is pretty much the same as his earlier rendition of the Pasuk in the Akedah, right? God does not have to learn something about what's in people's hearts. God always knows what's in people's hearts, but occasionally he gives people an opportunity to demonstrate what is in their hearts. Okay. Again, another addition, so to speak, to the text for the purpose of clarification. Okay. When Moses is referring to the fact that God singled out the tribe of Levi, and they were designated as the workers in the Mishkan, right? God set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the Aron, right? La Aron Brit Hashem, to carry the Ark of His Covenant, right? La Amod Lefnei Hashem L'Shato, to stand and to serve God, okay? Ulevarech Bishmo, and to give blessings in God's name, Ad Hayom Hazeh, and that is still the case, okay? Notice that Sa'adya adds two words in Arabic to the Hebrew text. He adds the words that explain something that the Pasuk in itself doesn't tell us. Pasuk tells us that God set the tribe of Levi apart, right? Don't you want to know why he set them apart? Now, of course, if you remember everything that you learned in third grade, you'd remember why it was that God set the tribe of Levi apart. But you might not remember that, right? By the time you get to this Pasuk in Sefer Devarim. So Sa'adya simply reminds you that the reason that God set them apart and gave them this honored status is because at the time of the golden calf, they, the tribe of Levi, came to Moses' side. They were his assistants and they helped him to help the people atone for their sin. Here too, the Torah seems to use the imperative. It says, "Som tasim alecha melech," as though it actually were a mitzvah of the Torah to appoint a king. And here you see the JPS already adopted Sa'adya's approach to it, which is that this is not obligatory. It's rather optional. And therefore he renders it as you may appoint a king. And here finally, the last slide. Okay. Moses himself, in his valedictory address to the Jewish people, Deuteronomy chapter 32, the Song of Ha'azinu, begins by calling upon the heavens and earth to listen to him. Ha'azinu ha'shamayim v'adabera tishma ha'aretz imrefi. Who is he talking to? Now, we can just simply say he's not talking to anybody, he's talking to the Jewish people. If he's talking to the Jewish people, what is he mentioning heaven and earth? It's poetic. Instead of saying, everybody listen, he says, may the whole universe listen. Does he really expect the planets Jupiter and Mars to listen to him? No, it's poetic. It's a form of exaggeration. Sa'adya said, no. He was addressing specific entities. When he said, heaven, listen, he was talking about things in heaven that are capable of listening. And what things in heaven are capable of listening? Angels. And we see again that it's preserved in Ibn Ezra's commentary here, where he tells us that the Gaon said that the meaning of heavens is the angels, and the meaning of earth is, of course, mankind, the people of the earth. So as I said, we see that there are a variety of different motives that Saadia had in rendering his Arabic translation of the Torah, ranging from sublime theological reasons to points of basic logic to items of context, and even then to things that were just simply matters of literary or linguistic style. Have a look at the chat.
Relatively quiet in the chat.
Yes. Well, I don't know. The question, Potamos Pishon, sound like it could come from the same family. I don't think they're related to each other at all. But if the word Potamos means river, philological interpretation of the word Pishon would connect it with the word Lafush, which means to flow. So it could be the flowing thing. That isn't particularly helpful because that can fit every river. Okay. As I said, but it clearly wasn't Yemenite. I'll have to see if I can't get a Yemenite recording. Okay. Night falls, but day breaks. I know that's kind of like, you park. You park your car. You drive on a parkway and you park in the driveway. I know. In Sadia's translation, is it in English? No. Safaria, for some reason that I don't understand, actually has the text of his Arabic translation. And for the life of me, I haven't been able to figure out why. Somebody must have just offered it to them and they put it up. But there is Rabbi Yosef Kafa, whom I've spoken of before, the late chief rabbi of the Yemenite community in Israel, put out a book through Mossad Rav Kook where he translates Saadia back into Hebrew. Now, of course, you ask me, wait a second, so why doesn't he just have the Chumash? So the answer is that he doesn't translate all of Saadia back into Hebrew. He translates back into Hebrew those portions of Saadia's Arabic translation that differ from the Hebrew. So that's the best that I can offer you. Ibn Ezra commentary available in English. I have no idea about Safaria. I must tell you, Safari is a wonderful thing, but you always have to be very careful because you can't always tell when the translation was done by somebody who really knew what they're doing and when the translation is a wiki. They'll joke about what is a camel. A camel is a committee made by a horse made by a committee. So when you get a committee together and they do a translation, it often produces camels. And that happens all too frequently on Safaria for my taste. But there is a website I have shown you before called alhatorah.org. And alhatorah has a feature. It's a tiny little icon of the letter E, of the capital letter E. And wherever a commentary is available in English, you click on the E and it gives you the English translation as well. So it has it on all of Rashi. It has it on most, if not all, of Rashbam. And I believe it has it on Ibn Ezra. It certainly has it on Ramban. And I mentioned that Yemenites conduct. Yes, some Yemenite congregations, when they read the Torah and the reader pauses and somebody recites the Aramaic translation of Onkelos, they might do it from this same book, from the Taj book. And there we go.
Okay, thank you. All right. Look forward to next week. And okay, I don't know how many more weeks you're planning on translations, Rabbi.
Just next week.
Oh,
we'll
just next
do the English. Week. We'll do some English next week, and then we'll move on.
Okay, I mean, whatever. There's no, from my perspective, no immediate hurry, but, you know, lots of stuff in English. And, of course, you know, I mean, it's very different. You know, Lindsay Guhart gave a 7-part series, Bichlal, on translation. So, but like I always say, it's always wonderful to hear different speakers address, you know, similar topics, each with their own perspective. And, of course, there's so much to discuss. Everybody discusses other things. But that you can listen to in our, whatever, about 2,000 lectures in the Torah Moshe Library on our archive page, then YouTube, and YouTube we only have really from when we started Zoom, but we have a 1,000 talks from, you know, the non-Shabbos talks for the previous 15 years before March 2020 when everything changed. So you can listen there. But okay, just to let you know, you haven't discovered that already. But anyways, okay, please go next week, tomorrow morning, or tomorrow at noon Eastern time. It's morning, I guess, on the West Coast. And evening in Israel, Shuli Mishkin will be back, of course, after taking off for him last week on her archaeology series. And then the Parsha Shir tomorrow night at 8:30, Siddur Shir Friday morning at 9 a.m., Rabbi Liebtag Sunday morning at 11:15, and then Monday continue with our Pesach series, so our special Pesach classes. So we hope we'll see you. Hope you'll invite a friend. That's our big request. Bring one, bring many. And everybody have a wonderful night and be well, and we should hear good things. Okay, thank you very much. Laila Tov.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And somebody was asking if we're going to have a class in Arabic, sent me privately. So I said, we should have a class, Judaism for Arabs, the one known in Dubai. That would be wonderful if we have a class, Judaism for Arabs.
No, there's a book on the subject. Katav, I think, a long time ago, published two books. One was an introduction to Judaism for Muslims, and the other was an introduction to Islam for Jews.
Right, so that's Lindy Guhart, who gave the translation series, just finished the 10-part series on Islam for Jews. You know, what Jews should know about Islam. So a whole history, right? But it'd be nice. Listen, I guess people are, I don't know, UAE, Dubai, you know, Baruch Hashem, the connection between Jews and Arabs in many respects are warming up.
That's you would have been a good. I taught Arabic for many years at Yeshiva College and at Stern College.
Honestly, really,
you
really?
Yeah.
You speak fluently Arabic?
Yeah.
Where did you pick up Arabic?
I spent a couple of years as a national defense fellow, studying Arabic.
Really?
And
you mean working for the U.S. government?
Well, the odds of their hiring somebody named Moshe to work as an Arabist were never very high. But they couldn't very well say that at the beginning. So the interesting thing is, I'll tell you just a curiosity, you would have done well in the class.
No, I'm not good at languages.
No. But there's one feature of Arabic that you would have done well at, for the same reason that Marty Byrne would have done well at it. And that is that I found that the only way in which I could explain how to distinguish between Arabic has two versions of the letter chet.
Ach.
One is the really guttural ch, and the other is a softer h. And the only way that I found effectively to teach students how to duplicate it was like this.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, I still don't think I would have done very well in the class, but how many people took Arabic at YU?
I was doing it during the, when did I do the Arabic? Must have been the late 80s, early 90s, through the mid 90s. Okay. I'd say there were occasions that I had 20 or more students in a class.
Cool. So that's after my time.
Nobody ever went for more than the first year. I mean, it was just, you know.
Yeah. It's okay. It's interesting. I don't know if any Jewish schools out teach Arabic. in here. That's Tremendous. I don't know, to see school. It used to be, you know, Chat used to teach Russian. She's Latin, Russian. They don't have, they teach Spanish now. There is a Spanish course, and of course French. But most Canadian, whatever, most people in Ontario after grade 9, when you have to stop taking French, a lot of them don't continue. But if you want to be Prime Minister of Canada, it's good to know French. Anyways, okay. Oh, SAR offers Arabic. That's very interesting. Okay, good. Yeah, I don't know any schools that are here. Bruria, okay. But I'm happy to hear all these Arabic places. Okay, very nice. Okay, good, good. Let's continue learning. Good to speak languages so we can communicate with each other, so we know each other's languages. Okay, Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you very much.